This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to Beyond Politics, broadcast on WKXL, available wherever you get your podcasts. You can check us out literally any platform that you use to get your podcast. You can find us listed as Beyond Politics. If you're already a subscriber, do us a favor, go in and give us a rating and a review. I mean, we'd prefer a five-star rating, but you know, we trust your judgment. It really does help us out. We are delighted to have a fascinating conversation set up for you here today. You know, there's a perception out there, and I think we fall into this habit ourselves, former Congressman Paul Hodes and I, about thinking about Congress, talking about Congress, and perceiving Congress as totally gridlocked, as stuck in the throes of parties that do nothing but bicker. And it's kind of distressing to people like us, former Congressman Paul Hodes, who devoted 4 years of his life to serving in the People's House, and me, I devoted over a decade of my life to being a staffer in Congress. And we care a lot about the institution itself. We believe in Congress. We have reverence for its preeminent role in our democracy. Let's not forget that the role of the Congress is laid out as the very first order of business in our Constitution. It's Article 1. Now, our guest today says that maybe we're all being a little too negative. There's actually reason to be a bit more hopeful because Congress gets more done while you're not looking than you'd think. Francis Lee is a professor of politics and public affairs. She's the associate chair of the Department of Politics at Princeton University, and she's the author of numerous books and articles on politics and American government. Dr. Lee, welcome.
Great to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, and it's a pleasure to have this conversation because I, for one, after the last year that we've all just had, I'm looking forward to a conversation that's maybe a little bit more upbeat and hopeful, although I'm sure that Paul and I, as good Democrats, will work in a little bit of dour, down-in-the-mouth negativism along the way. Let me start off with a quote that you gave to Vox as part of an article about Senator Joe Manchin, in which you said something that really caught my eye and I think launched us onto this whole discussion. In the midst of this article, the author says that the popular narrative of a gridlocked do-nothing Congress has been complicated in your eyes. And what you said is, I would really like to put to rest this idea that the current Congress is gridlocked after 2020. That was an amazing year, a transformative year. So did Congress actually get more done in 2020 than people realize? What was it and why was it so significant?
Congress accomplished far more in 2020 than is well understood. Most importantly, of course, is the series of COVID aid packages that Congress legislated, by far the most generous response to the pandemic of any advanced democracy. The aid packages for the unemployed, the aid to businesses, to hospitals, to airlines. It was comprehensive. There's really nothing we can compare the CARES Act to in terms of this, the scale of the legislation. And then even after enacting that package, they came back again in December of 2020 with another $900 billion aid package. Just to offer a little perspective, $900 billion is more than the Pentagon receives in a year. And so by the time you add up the five COVID aid packages passed in 2020, you're talking about more than 15% of GDP. It was a very aggressive response. And even though unemployment increased massively across the country, more than 30 million people lost their jobs at the height of the pandemic recession, income did not fall. Poverty did not increase. I mean, this is a muscular response on a scale. I'm frankly surprised it was even possible to do. And this happened in the context of intense partisan conflict, a House and Senate controlled by different parties, a presidential election year, and on the heels of a presidential impeachment. I mean, all the things that you would expect to make it impossible for the Congress to act in a muscular way, and yet it did. And I don't think that there's enough appreciation for what actually occurred. It is transformative, and it demonstrates the capacity of the national government to respond to great need on the part of the American people. And of course, that's not all. That doesn't account for all the legislation that occurred in 2020. It was also a significant energy package that was rolled into the December legislation that you can easily make the case is the most important climate legislation that Congress has ever passed, including a significant reduction in hydrofluorocarbons, which are far more consequential for the climate. And you can see that a great deal of aid on for energy efficiency, for carbon research, and no coverage of this package. In addition to that, there was finally a deal after many years of negotiation. Finally, a deal on surprise medical billing in December. We can add on that there was also, in June of 2020, a large package aiding the national parks. You know, 1.3 million new acres of wilderness designated, and done in a bipartisan manner. I mean, there's just a lot that occurred in 2020, and it's interesting to me how little attention congressional successes receive. Now, part of it is Congress's own fault in that, if you're going to pass all this legislation in one single large package, it's going to wind up being covered as, Congress prevents the government from shutting down. That's basically how the December package got covered. But it was far more consequential than that. So part of it is the omnibus nature of legislation today. So that it's just too much when Congress actually does legislate, it's too much to digest all at once. But second, there's just a news media bias in favor of conflict, that partisan attacks get so much more attention than bipartisan legislation, when legislation is, of course, far more consequential for the American people than the latest partisan attack. But the partisan attack is exciting. It garners clicks and it garners news, viewers, and so it is more useful from the vantage point of the profit motive of media organizations rather than informing people about what's actually happening in national politics and policymaking.
It's interesting. My mind is boggled. Officially, I am now sitting here boggled as an observer, mostly through the media these days, of what has been happening in politics since my days in Congress. I have watched, observed, heard, and experienced the steady progression of a rising level of animosity, at least as reported in the media, and statements by members of Congress themselves. I mean, when I was in Congress, I was always struck, even way back then, I served from 2007 to 2011, leader Kevin McCarthy and I and a group of members of the class that we were, the class of 2006, would get together for dinners at a bad Chinese restaurant near the Capitol. And we would have these wonderful, friendly dinners, avoiding food poisoning where we could, but having conversations about, our families and our kids and what it was like back home and the weather. And we generally, we had a relationship. There was a cross the aisle relationship. And then You know, I remember clearly, I forget the name of my colleague from Georgia. We were sitting next to each other and sharing egg rolls, and we got back to the floor the next day. And I had a bill that was a bill designed to prevent the Pentagon from propagandizing citizens at home, because there had been a lot of misinformation spread. This was in the wake of the war in Iraq. The Pentagon had basically, you know, done a propaganda job. And I had a bill to stop that. Anyway, this lovely, lovely, friendly representative from Georgia then got on the floor and said the most terrible things about me and the bill and what I was trying to do to America. And I mean, it was, I sat there just saying, is this the same guy that I broke egg rolls with the night before? And it's, you know, to a lot of people, it's only gotten worse and worse. So that while you've just told us that while Donald Trump was president, the Congress of the United States passed incredible landmark legislation, as you said, the most important energy bill ever passed in December of 2020, while Donald Trump was president, all we've heard about is Sturm und Drang, war and destruction, flamethrowers, and crazy talk. I don't get it. How is this, as a member of the fake media myself, how does this work?
There is a real disjuncture between what actually happens legislatively and what garners media attention. I think we just have to begin there with understanding that Congress has a severe public relations problem. That, you know, it doesn't get the credit that it deserves for the legislation that it does pass and the problems that it does solve. Now, it's not to say that, you know, Congress is addressing all of the needs of the American people. I don't want to be interpreted as making that sort of claim, but it does more than is understood. And part of that is a result of the media filter that gets in the way. Now, members of Congress themselves participate in that. I mean, just in your example, you know, you could have a civil conversation in private, but then, you know, when members take the floor, they, you know, use this, you know, harsh, demonizing rhetoric, you know, accusing the other side of, you know, undermining the country. And of course, then that garners news attention. And so it helps to feed that narrative. Now, it's also the case that relations between the parties are very difficult now, and even more so here in 2021 than in 2020. I mean, after the riots at the Capitol on January 6th, I mean, relations are very strained. But the fact about the American political system, you know, the bicameral Congress, the frequency of divided government, it's just very difficult to legislate without bipartisan agreement. And so you rarely see legislation get passed on the model of, the Affordable Care Act. I mean, that rarely happens. It's not the norm of how legislation passes in the polarized Congress. But the system basically forces the sides to come to the table. They don't enjoy it. It's not pleasant. It often means disappointing your base voters, no matter who's in power. But they manage to do it, particularly when the need is great. Congress has a capacity to respond, especially in times of crisis, that we shouldn't underrate. And we saw that on an enormous, unprecedented scale last year, that I don't think has been digested at all. Like, it amazes me to listen to the narratives about congressional gridlock proceed as if nothing happened last year, when it was immense.
Well, let me ask, I feel a certain amount. First of all, Paul, quick, just kudos to you, because I think that's a really interesting story you just told. I hear a lot in the popular media, you know, the problem with our country is that members of Congress don't go to dinner anymore. And what I just heard you say is, hey, look, we went to dinner plenty. I don't remember the name of that Chinese place. I'm picturing it. They had the fish tank, the big fish tank in the front lobby. I don't remember what the heck it's called. Right. Anyway, yes, you could definitely die after a meal there. But you went and risked your life there plenty with Republicans. You got along famously. You're a pretty affable guy. That didn't solve all our country's problems. But anyway, Dr. Lee, the main question I want to ask you is, I feel a certain amount of cognitive dissonance here. On the one hand, you're telling a story that actually makes a lot of sense to me. I can attest there's an awful lot that happens when people aren't looking, from just, you know, whether it's in the form of individual appropriations bills, which we don't pass anymore. We tend to pass everything in omnibus bills, as you say. So there's an awful lot of fine print hidden in there. But that means there's an awful lot happening in there. A lot of important policy, a lot of important programs are funded. There's a lot getting done. That resonates for me. That makes a lot of sense for me. And from a certain standpoint, as you tick off the accomplishments of 2020, and then Paul, you and I are fresh off a conversation last week on the Balance of Power Roundtable show, where we were saying, gosh, it seems like there's some hope on infrastructure. There's beginning to be a little bit of movement there. There's beginning to be some movement towards Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina's proposal on policing reform. We might get some stuff done this year. So part of my brain says, you know what? There's a good news story here, and maybe we're just not telling it. On the other hand, I can't get over the fact that we are 5.5 months removed from my former colleagues and friends still working in Congress, hiding under desks and barricading doors to protect themselves from an insurrectionist, I don't even want to call it mob, but a violent group that was intent on causing death and destruction under the Capitol Dome. It was a true insurrection. So how do you square those two circles? How do you put together... Are both things true at the same time? Are we both, you know, on the verge of flying apart as a country politically and surprisingly getting things done at the same time? Or is one story more true than the other?
Yes, I think both things are true. And I think one way to reconcile what's happening in these two arenas is to understand that the political parties in U.S. national politics have been locked in a ferociously tight competition for control of national government. 1980, if we think about the Senate, you know, that's when the seemingly permanent Democratic majority of the 20th century came to an end, 1980 in the Senate, 1994, after 1994 in the House. Since that time, majorities have been narrow. Almost every election holds out the prospect of change of party control of one institution or another. And so this incentivizes the parties to drive narratives to undercut their opposition, you know, to make the case that we should be, if you have the majority, that you should be able to hold on to it, or if you don't have the majority, to make the case for your return to power. So that means to say that everything that the other guys are doing, they're doing it wrong, you know, that we would do things so much better if we had the reins. And so there's been a staffing up of communications capabilities in the Congress, many more communicators hired who work on media outreach to try to build these narratives. So, and of course, members of Congress experienced that it's personally that it's much easier to get media attention when you go out and launch an attack. So you've got the news incentives to play up conflict. You've got the party's incentives to wage that battle for institutional control. And so what's going on in the political realm, in the realm of narratives, in the realm of news coverage, emphasizes the conflict, the dysfunction, the bickering. But Congress works on multiple tracks, and legislation does still happen, particularly when there is a powerful felt need that's shared across both parties. You know, Congress has a hard time. It's very difficult for a party to deliver on a partisan program. You know, Republicans, despite having unified control, failed to repeal and replace Obamacare. If we go back to the Obama years, Democrats, despite having unified control and briefly 60 votes in the Senate, failed to pass a major climate bill. Congress has a great deal of difficulty delivering on partisan programs. Even when you give a party unified control, it rarely succeeds. But there's a lot of legislation that's occurring. In fact, the number of pages of enacted legislative text hasn't even declined since the 1980s. It's basically flat. Congress passes fewer bills, but the bills are so much bigger. It's actually relatively constant how much Congress is getting done if we just look in terms of sheer volume of output. So I think sometimes when we think about gridlock, we're confusing ourselves. Yes, it's hard for parties to deliver on a partisan program because it takes bipartisan agreement to legislate in the U.S. system most of the time. You mostly have divided government. That's 75% of the time since 1980. So you're not going to see legislation on party lines very often. And even then, even when you give parties the opportunity, they have trouble, holding their ranks together sufficiently. The majorities are usually quite narrow, so you need nearly perfect unity to do it. And then there's the Senate filibuster, which gets in the way too. So you add all this up, you can't legislate unless you have bipartisan agreement. So there's the two realms. You have the realm of narrative and of media coverage that focuses on the partisan conflict. And then you've got the reality of what the institution is actually doing, which is almost always bipartisan in legislative outputs. If we just look at the law, we just look at the votes that result in the enactment of laws, there hasn't even been polarization in Congress. There's no increase in the frequency of laws being enacted on party line votes in the polarized Congress.
I want to first take us into the Wayback Machine, because I'm a good Democrat. And as a good Democrat, the thing I do best is whine and moan and complain and say, oh, woe is me. I mean, that's what Democrats specialize in, because, we need an enemy. We need somebody to blame. We need to claim that we're fixing everything the Republicans messed up. And that's what Democrats do. We know when the Republicans are in, they mess it up and we have to come and clean up their mess. And so way back when, in the Wayback Machine, it came time for a significant piece of legislation, Obamacare. And it got watered down and watered down and watered down by Democrats, because Democrats couldn't agree on what was really going to make it work. And we finally got something, and it passed without a single Republican vote and not a single Republican proposal. We couldn't even get those guys. And I mean that in the non-gender specific way. We couldn't get those guys to give us an idea of what they wanted to do, except keep on shoveling money to the insurance companies. So we passed it in the House, and then it went over to the Senate, where it got watered down some more, and we lost the ability to have a public option because of Democrats and not a single Republican vote. And in the next election cycle, where I was the United States senatorial candidate for the Democratic Party in New Hampshire, I got walloped. I got clobbered. I got smashed. I got vilified because I had voted for health care. And what I heard over and over again from the citizenry was government's going to take over my health care. You just keep your darn hands off my Medicare. That's what I heard in diner after diner. The Republican message machine had done its job vilifying Democrats. Yet, as you point out, they couldn't overturn Obamacare even when the other guys took control. Now, fast forward, here we are a decade later, and what started out as a Tea Party has now grown by leaps and bounds into a society so polarized that a significant number of people apparently traveled to Washington, D.C., armed with various kinds of armaments, and tried to not only take over the Capitol, they stormed the Capitol in a scene. I mean, it was cinematic. It was a cinematic riot, a mob that stormed the Capitol waving Confederate flags and "Don't Tread on Me" flags. They erected a guillotine. They wanted to hang people. They wanted to hang Republicans and Democrats alike. So you had this bipartisan scene of crazy. And now here we are in 2021, and we've got a kind of competent, boring government happening. We've got Mr. Riding with Biden, who is just getting stuff done. And the Republicans seem to be coming apart at the seams. Liz Cheney is now telling tales. Liz Cheney wants to remake the Republican Party. She gets thrown out of leadership. What's going on? I mean, it seems like the partisanship has reached such a fever pitch that Mitch McConnell, in a redux, a replay of the Obama years, has now said that his job is to stand 100% against anything that Joe Biden wants to do. I'm going to be 100% against it. Now, what is a good Democrat to do but whine and moan about prospects going forward? How do you put the January 6th insurrection with members of Congress voting against certifying the election, with members of Congress making fists to the demonstrators, with crazies like Marjorie Taylor Greene in Congress? How do we make sense of this in light of your hopeful analysis of progress?
As I reflect back on January 6th, I see exactly what you're describing, legacy of stoking animosity, fear, and hatred among the base of a political party, telling them that they'd been defrauded of an election. And that, so you can see, that what happened on January 6th flows directly from all of that rhetoric that they have been fed for years. On the other hand, I think as we look back on January 6th, the most significant moment was Congress's decision to reconvene, to continue the electoral vote count that same night. Everyone understood when the decision was made to do that, what the outcome would be. And yet there was no boycott among even the strong supporters of the president, President Trump, who had denounced the election as fraudulent. They didn't attempt to delegitimize the count. Instead, they participated. Now, yes, it's true. Many continued to vote against the certification of particular slates of electors in particular states. But it was still understood when they reconvened what the outcome was going to be. There was not in doubt, and yet decided to participate in it. That's where I again see that split screen Congress, as it's sometimes referred to. You have the harsh rhetoric, the demonization, the tremendous polarization, and yet still a capacity for the institution to function when it's needed, and to function when it really counts, which is that Congress effectively legitimized the 2020 election outcome. The normally the candidates do that. The losing candidate concedes. That did not happen after 2020. So the task was left to Congress, was highly fraught. That's of course why there was a large protest and a mob assault on the Capitol, because many Americans had been led to believe that the election was fraudulent. But Congress still managed to come together to certify the outcome. And I think that's important and underrated. Congress is still working through the fallout from that terrible day. And in fact, the Capitol grounds are still fenced off from the public. But I don't think we should underrate the significance of Congress coming together that same day to finish the work.
Despite that resiliency, you alluded a few minutes ago to a bit of a demarcation in American politics in the way the political parties communicated around 1980, when the dominance of the Democratic Party in the Senate ended, 1994 in the House. Of course, we all tend to think, people of our generation tend to think back to 1994 as sort of the Newt Gingrich-led Republican Revolution, as sort of the dividing line there. One of the things that I observed as a staffer in the wake of that 1994 revolution when I was working on Congress was a real and palpable change in the way that both parties communicated, a realization that there was no advantage to moderating one's own speech. There was actually an advantage to taking one's own speech to an extreme, because if you said something outlandish, it was going to provoke a reaction. And, you know, it's that old thing of like, never, what is it? Never wrestle with a pig, never get down because you both get covered in mud, or never get into an argument with an idiot because onlookers won't be able to tell the difference. In that charge and countercharge, your original extreme attack on the other side would get plenty of coverage, plenty of play, muddy the waters and the minds of the American public, and it would be more effective than giving something a little bit more nuanced and mealy-mouthed in the middle. And now, of course, in the era of Donald Trump, we really have seen that entire communication style completely take over. It is the dominant form of political communications in America, the total demonization of the other side. Now, part of that, I think, you're the political scientist, not me, but I think part of that is explainable by the realignment of the parties, that the ideology of each party has really sorted itself into distinct poles on the right and the left. You don't have the same kind of swing vote in the middle that you used to have. So some of that is going to be awfully hard to change. But is there a way to put some of this toothpaste back into the tube? Is there any way to reel back some of this extremity in communication, the political incentive that each party has to maximally demonize the other side?
I'm highly skeptical of institutional fixes here. Incentives that members and staff, for that matter, have to engage in these partisan attacks are deeply rooted. That if you want as a member of Congress to get attention, how do you do it? Passing a significant piece of bipartisan legislation, participating in that, that's not going to work. The way you get attention is the attack. How do you get attention for your boss? How do you go viral in social media? That harsh. Who are the most famous members of Congress now? They are the hardest line members with the most extreme profiles. Fundraising also encourages this behavior. It helps members raise money for the next campaign. It is very effective. Go back to the Obama years and Joe Wilson shouting "You lie" at the State of the Union address. That helped him raise a lot of money. I mean, members have learned that this behavior gets rewards, many rewards. It's hard for me to see what kinds of little tweaks we might be able to make that could stand up against the incentives of the whole media environment that we inhabit and the campaign finance realities that members face. These are large problems of political incentives.
It leads me, your answer leads me to the following question. Given the change in the external communications and media environment that we have seen over the past decade. As I sometimes point out, when I got to Congress, there basically was no Google or Facebook or social media. There were no iPads. There were no iPhones. We were on Blackberries. And quickly over the period of time we saw the rise of the use of social media by Obama in innovative ways. And over the past decade, we, as analog beings trapped in a digital world, have tried to evolve to the fast-changing impact of Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Snitch, Twitch, and all the other things that, you know, whoever knows what's coming next. And as officially a geezer, it's hard for me to keep up with how younger generations are communicating. But it has completely changed, it seems to me, the media environment. The impact of this pandemic has, if anything, accelerated the trend towards digital communication as the default mode of communication. And that gives every single person, I suppose, in an increasingly democratic way, a loud voice in the public opinion forum, sometimes informed, sometimes not, but it seems to have elevated opinion over education. Now, with that diatribe on the one hand, as our politics have changed, do institutions like Congress, voting, campaign laws, and other norms or rules that govern our democracy have to innovate? And if so, how do you see, what innovations do you see as necessary in order to keep things functioning? Or to make functioning better?
I see Congress as having innovated and found ways to continue to keep functioning despite all these pressures that push it in dysfunctional directions. That, you know, I see omnibus legislating as one answer that Congress has developed. That, you know, because legislation can rarely be enacted on simple party lines, you know, R's versus D's, bipartisan deals are necessary. They tend to disappoint the base. They don't tend to get you the coverage that you want. So the easiest way to do that is to just take your medicine all at once. They do it in these large packages. You can spend a lot of your time attacking the other side. You can continue to, excite the voters who, pay attention to politics. You can fight the good fight in the media narratives, but then on the other hand, legislation does get done. Omnibus legislating helps to solve a lot of political problems for Congress. If this all goes through at once, then you can move on to the political tasks ahead. The realities of the political environment that members inhabit today. So I see Congress as having found ways to keep functioning despite incentives that are problematic. I have my doubts as to whether reforms like, say, nonpartisan districting or open primaries would make that much of a difference. And this comes out of just the work I follow in political science. That I haven't, we don't have good evidence that these reforms will have a significant impact. That, think about redistricting. Redistricting is high stakes for members of Congress, but it does not consistently reduce competition in congressional elections. That we haven't seen that. And in fact, redistricting often promotes competition. And when parties are attempting to gerrymander in such a way that they can maximize their seats there, they design a lot of somewhat competitive constituencies, so that they can spread their voters off across more districts in the hopes of winning more seats. And of course, we've seen partisanship rise in the House and the Senate simultaneously, even though the Senate is not redistricted. So I don't think a redistricting reform will have that much of an effect. We also don't see that more competitive members representing more competitive seats don't behave in manners that are markedly different than members who represent safe seats. that so that the data are just not there to say that we have a, you know, we have some clear fixes that will work to depolarize our politics. Same thing if we look at states with open primaries versus closed primaries. They don't result in member, the closed primary states don't have more polarized members. So we just don't have, I come away from this questions about the conventional wisdom about the institutional reforms that might work than, an ability to say, here's my program, do X, Y, and Z, and we'll be able to depolarize our politics. That the evidence is just not there to support a program of that nature.
Well, let's spin that forward to really the ultimate question of where all this is leading to if we're forward-looking about it. I mentioned earlier the kind of the sense of cognitive dissonance I had between the good news, bad news story here. As you look forward over the next 5 to 10 years, you actually wrote a book about this called The Limits of Party, about whether we have the capacity to keep governing ourselves as a democracy. You actually edited a volume that put it succinctly in the title, Can America Govern Itself? So based on all of your scholarship and all your work, what do you think is the answer to that question? As you look forward, are we going to continue to be able to govern ourselves?
What a co-author, Jim Curry, and I found in The Limits of Party was that there had been less change in congressional outputs in terms of what Congress actually does legislatively than one might expect. That, you know, we know that how Congress operates has changed tremendously, so much more partisan than it was in the 1970s and 1980s. We know that the parties, put forward these starkly different platforms when they campaign, and that's different than in the past. We know that the leaders wield much more power over legislative negotiations than they used to. But what we don't find is that parties are more effective at delivering on their programs. What we don't find is that more laws are being enacted on party line votes. What we find is continuity. So, the U.S. national government is hard to move. It's a decentralized system with many veto players, but it has ever been thus that we don't find major change in terms of what Congress is getting done or what national government does. Instead, what we find is continuity over time. So it's not to be overly sunny and to say that things are working out as they should and that the American people are getting the government they need, but it's not markedly different, despite the changes in partisanship and in the operations of national government.
Well, at the top of the show, we promised our listeners that they would get a more hopeful, more upbeat perspective than perhaps they were getting from the media, and that during the course of the show, we would be sure to deliver on the classic Democratic downbeat and maybe all hope is lost kind of perspective that the American public is used to. I think we've delivered on both of those promises. Dr. Lee, thank you so much for bringing us your scholarship and perspective on why maybe there's more of a good news story embedded here than we're used to, and a little bit more hope looking forward. For my co-host, former Congressman Paul Hodes, I'm Matt Robeson. Thank you for listening on WKXL. And again, if you are listening on Beyond Politics in your podcast feed, please give us a great rating and make sure you've subscribed.